Good morning.
I want to know what you all did with all the women lawyers. Where have you hidden them? Okay. All right. This is Appeal 074058, Interactive Intelligence versus KeyCorp, and it's Mr. Overhauser. Good morning.
May it please the Court. I know you're familiar with the facts of the case, but I hope to take just a couple of minutes to summarize the key facts and then to discuss three issues. First, the statute of limitations on Interactive's breach of contract claim, the third-party beneficiary claim, and finally, the dismissal of the class allegations by the lower court. Just to quickly summarize the key facts, this case involves a rogue trader of KeyBank who overcharged Interactive Intelligence to the tune of $2.1 million. In about 1998, KeyBank agreed to provide foreign currency exchange services to Interactive, and one key element of that agreement was that KeyBank was not to charge a spread on the transactions or a percentage adjustment to the exchange rate, but instead a flat processing fee.
You know, Mr. Overhauser, I have a sort of bottom line question, I guess, and it's this. In the contract, Interactive agreed that it was not relying on any advice, counsel, or representations of KeyBank in entering into any FX transaction, and that it had consulted with its own legal, regulatory, tax, business, investing, financial, accounting advisors. Wouldn't that alone make it clear that this was not, is not a fiduciary relationship? Help me with that.
First of all, I don't agree with that document's characterization as a contract. Its authenticity is disputed. The piece of paper is not signed by either party. You may have noted that in the record at 553, KeyBank submitted four pages. The first three pages all contained a common footer in the lower left-hand corner. The fourth page, which is the purported terms and conditions, doesn't contain that same footer. Regardless, that written document is irrelevant to the issue of summary judgment on the oral contract claim, since it's undisputed that KeyBank's rogue trader started processing Interactive's transactions before the document even existed. Even if the document was a contract, KeyBank has still admitted that Interactive was overcharged by a rogue trader. Interactive's claim is limited to breach of an oral contract.
I just want to make one thing clear. You're saying that the contract was not signed by Interactive?
The page, there is a page of terms and conditions that is referenced by KeyBank, but that page bears no signature.
But the rest of it does.
There are other pages. It is unclear whether or not the page that KeyBank submitted as terms and conditions was actually the same document referenced in the other pages that do contain a signature. But the key point, Your Honor, is that many of the FX transactions that are governed by the oral contract occurred before this document was even in existence. And so clearly, those, at a minimum, those ones are subject to Interactive's breach of oral contract claim. The effect of this written document that you refer to, I think, would just be an issue of fact for the trier of fact to resolve and see how it affects the breach of oral contract claim. But one of the key terms of the oral contract was that KeyBank was not to charge a spread or a percentage adjustment to the exchange rate.
Well, a certain amount of money is paid as part of this exchange rate. Isn't it relatively easy to find out that you were overcharged?
It's not easy to find out you're overcharged.
I mean, aren't these exchange rates public knowledge?
Not the exchange rates that, not KeyBank's internal exchange rates. There is unequivocal testimony at deposition that was submitted in which KeyBank testified that it kept its exchange rates confidential. That was his standard.
Do you know what the bottom line is that you paid for a particular transaction, don't you?
Well, we know now. Now, after the fact, we have found out during the course of discovery.
Well, this went on for years and years, didn't it?
Well,
and you know how much you were charged. And isn't it like, you know, you buy a Buick or something and you find out a week later you paid too much for it or something?
Well, I think it was reasonable for Interactive to assume that KeyBank would respect the contract that it would reach, which was not to charge a spread. And I think your question really gets to the issue of did Interactive have some type of an obligation, perhaps, to discover the discrepancies sooner? And the answer to that question is no. I don't think Interactive can be held responsible for overseeing KeyBank's rogue traders, especially those that go to the lengths that Adam Ravens did to conceal his actions. You may recall on the record, there's a quotation of a note that he made in which he said, make sure there are no incoming and outgoing transactions on the same value date. I'd also note that apparently even the management of KeyBank was not fully aware of Mr. Raven's rogue trading and overcharging until Interactive complained, because it was not until then that they let him go. KeyBank admits that it kept its internal exchange rates secret from Interactive and all its other customers, and KeyBank also conceded that it is impossible to calculate KeyBank's internal exchange rates by referring to external sources like the Wall Street Journal.
What indication is there that KeyBank, in utilizing the Code of Ethics, intended to recognize a right of performance in beneficiaries such as Interactive? I mean, isn't it clear that Interactive was at most an incidental beneficiary of the Code of Ethics?
Well, it's important to distinguish two very different key documents in this case. One was KeyBank's Code of Ethics, but the second were the separate signed written agreements that KeyBank had with its employees in which they agreed to comply with the Code of Ethics. Now, Interactive is not claiming that merely because a company has a Code of Ethics that the company's customers are third-party beneficiaries. And Interactive is not claiming that KeyBank's Code of Ethics, standing alone, is a contract. However, here, we have more than a bare code of ethics. We have...
But forgive me, but what's... I think you were probably going into what the evidence is that Interactive, which, of course, is a customer of the defendants, how it was a third-party beneficiary of the code of ethics. Is that what you're going into?
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay.
I'm so excited to be sitting here. I'm falling off my chair.
Well, I think the court should bear in mind that the facts of this case are relatively narrow. First of all, KeyBank takes the Code of Ethics very seriously. They have their own ethics compliance officer, and that ethics compliance officer testified that Interactive was a beneficiary of the Code of Ethics. The Code of Ethics itself repeatedly mentions customers and the importance of relationships and treating customers honestly. KeyBank employees all voluntarily signed contracts agreeing to comply with the Code of Ethics. These signed agreements prominently recite, in all capital letters and in all bold letters, condition of employment. Even that query is a term of art that relates to a contract law, the word condition. KeyBank even publicizes the Code of Ethics on its website and uses it to attract new customers. Other courts have allowed third parties to enforce codes of ethics with far fewer facts than we have here. The point is, Your Honors, nobody forced KeyBank to publicize its code of ethics on its website. No one forced KeyBank to require every employee to sign a contract agreeing to respect it. KeyBank voluntarily took these actions to further its own business interests and reputation. These are facts that distinguish this case from other businesses that just have a bare code of ethics and nothing else, and for which third-party beneficiary status should not apply. But given that the defendant has held itself out to the public as ethical, has reaped profits from doing so, it would be unjust for the defendants to escape liability for its own rogue traders who breach the code of ethics and overcharge.
Let's go here. If Interactive, or right, no, how can Interactive demonstrate that KeyBank had actual knowledge that Ravens was overcharging and failed to address it?
How can it be proven? Well, first of all, during the course of discovery, KeyBank produced the personnel file for Adam Ravens, and that personnel file noted that Mr. Ravens had been chastised by his supervisors for being too aggressive in trading, and that KeyBank had been losing customers as a consequence. The record also indicates some computerized printouts showing the FX transactions that were executed by Adam Ravens.
But too aggressive doesn't necessarily translate into overcharging, does it?
Not necessarily, but remember, in this case, Interactive had a contract not to charge a spread, and it's evident from these reports that a spread was being applied. If you don't have any further questions along those lines, I would just like to point out one of the errors with regard to the third-party beneficiary of the lower court. The lower court, in denying or granting summary judgment, I should say, on the third-party beneficiary claim, said that it could find no cases to support the conclusion that, and I'm quoting the lower court, quote, a code of ethics in the workplace makes a customer a third-party beneficiary of that code, unquote. That sounds to me as though the lower court was looking only to the code of ethics and that it completely ignored the dozens of separate contracts signed by KeyBank employees agreeing to comply with the code of ethics. I'd like to take a moment just to talk about the lower court's dismissal of the class action allegations. Class certification was sought for Interactive's third-party beneficiary and negligence claims. However, before any class discovery took place, the court dismissed the class allegations. Now, based on the briefs, I believe that KeyBank and I and Adam Ravens, I think we all agree that a motion to dismiss standard is the proper one to apply where a court dismisses class action allegations prior to class discovery. What that means is that the class action allegations in the complaint must be deficient on their face for them to be dismissed before discovery. But here, the lower court did not accept as true the complaint's allegations, but instead made assumptions about what those facts might be. In essence, the lower court applied the incorrect legal standard in dismissing the class allegations. For example, the lower court said it might have to determine, quote, the applicable code of ethics for each transaction, unquote, and that this would be, quote, a time-consuming and fact-sensitive inquiry that would not lend itself to class-wide determination, unquote. However, since that ruling was made, discovery has proven the court's assumption to have been wrong. For example, the contracts signed by KeyBank employees to comply with the Code of Ethics are all a standard form. These are in the appendix at pages 211 to 327. There are only a couple of versions of the Code of Ethics, and the relevant provisions of them are identical from one version to the next. There are a number of other examples of how the court failed to accept the complaint's class action allegations as true that are in our brief. It's rare to have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight on a vision like this, But in this case, it confirms that the trial court did not accept as true the class allegations of the complaint.
You're in your rebuttal. I am.
If there are no further questions, I simply ask the grant of summary judgment be dismissed and class allegations be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Overhauser. Good morning, Mr. Brown.
Good morning.
You have 13 minutes and Mr. Gaither has 7.
Yes, thank you.
That doesn't seem like a fair.
We'll try to use it. We're working together on this. Interactive Intelligence is a publicly traded company, and of course, KeyBank is a national business association. And the allegation here is that Key and Ravens overcharge for foreign currency exchange transactions. And obviously, we feel that the grant of summary judgment was correct. And that is true for three reasons fundamentally. First, foreign currency exchange transactions are completely unregulated. There are no statutory or regulatory limits, and that goes without saying, I believe. And certainly the appellants don't contend it's otherwise. Second, the transactions between Key and Interactive were governed by a written contract, and that contract contained no restrictions on how much Key could charge for FX transactions. And as the bench has correctly noted, it also provided representations on the part of Interactive that, in fact, it was doing it based on its own advice, legal, financial, investment, and the like. I would also, in digression, suggest to the court that this idea that that written agreement, which came into effect on May 1, 2001, the suggestion that it is somehow invalid strikes me as a new issue, not in the brief. I would refer the court to the supplemental appendix, which is page 556, and that is where the court will find reference to the written agreement itself. And just by way of further digression, the oral agreement claim is a claim that, in our opinion, can only survive until that written agreement was signed on May 1, 2001, because it contains the normal types of language one would expect in a commercial agreement, essentially saying that it is the agreement, the only agreement, that it rejects any proposals or offers, and all modifications must be in writing. So in terms of the oral contract claim, if that oral contract has any legs at all, those legs are cut off as of May 1, 2001, which is when the written agreement comes into effect, and the parties move forward from that point. Getting back to my main themes, unregulated area, we have a written contract that kicks in as of May 1, 2001, which leaves the appellants in a situation where they're essentially attempting to find a common law host for claiming that they were overcharged in a commercial relationship, neither unregulated nor capped by contract. And the hosts that they have attempted to select are breach of fiduciary duty, breach of oral contract or third-party beneficiary contract, or negligence. I'm here to talk about the breach of fiduciary duty, the breach of oral contract, and the negligence. Mr. Gaither is going to handle the third-party beneficiary piece. Again, we talked about the lack of regulation in this market, and let's talk a bit about the written contract. It contained no pricing constraints, and the bench had questions about how one would discern what one was actually paying through these transactions. These were well-papered transactions. The way the process worked through the contract and through the agreement they reached and the internet access that was granted to Interactive was they would put in their requested transaction information, which is, we want $1,000 converted to euros to be paid to a third party. When that would occur, there would be a written confirmation that would be sent out to Interactive. That written confirmation would specifically include the precise exchange rate that KeyBank was charging. In addition to that, by contract, again referencing 556, that contract would indicate that Interactive had a period of 2 business days in order to challenge the accuracy of that transaction or point out any errors. So the materials that Interactive had at its disposal was a specific written confirmation of the amount of exchange that KeyBank was going to be gathered. And if one wanted to attempt to discern how much the spread was that was being taken, you only had to consult many publicly available sources, the Wall Street Journal, the internet or whatever it might be in the comparison of what Key was charging versus what the listed trade date would show you what the spread was going to be on that day and what the profit was that was being taken. So let's think about the transparency of this market, because that's important. We're essentially confronted with a claim in a commercial arm's length transaction that we failed to fully reveal our cost of goods sold, because we are talking about a commodity and an unregulated one at that. So this isn't like a situation where you have no idea what your widget manufacturer is charging. This is a transparent market where you know basically the cost of the commodity that's being sold. We provide you with the sales price, and the simple act of subtraction tells you exactly what spread is being taken. And that was the methodology that was followed throughout this entire period of time. Now, did Interactive itself have knowledge of the methodology by which it could determine what the cost of the foreign transactions were? The answer to that is absolutely yes, and the record is replete with admissions by Interactive's people that they were aware of the public sources from which this information could be discerned. The fellow who was in charge of this on the financial side, their controller, Mr. Midkiff, acknowledged that when he went to MBA school in 92 and 93, he was well aware that these exchange rates were routinely published. They also acknowledged that from time to time, in order to figure out how much they were going to pay their vendors, they would in fact look at the Wall Street Journal to have some understanding of how many dollars they would have to put forward to Key Bank in order to make sure that their vendors' payment was being covered in a foreign currency.
Mr. Brown, are you going to be responding to the negligence claim?
I am.
Okay, then, when you responded to it in the brief, you focused on the Code of Ethics. But how do you respond to Interactive's claim that its negligence claim is premised on the failure to train or supervise?
I think,
and it, you know, exists regardless of the court's conclusions.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't mean to cut you off. I think the fundamental point to be made about negligence is that we have a commercial transaction and a commercial relationship that's governed and circumscribed by the contract. And we think the law is quite clear, at least in Indiana, that in such a relationship, the duties owed by the parties is determined by the contract. And this concept of negligence being imposed in a situation where the party's conduct is and obligations are defined by the contract just doesn't exist. It does not operate to expand the obligations assumed by the parties
but
in their contract.
It seems to me, would take responsibility for a failure to take action, to stop Raven's aggressive spending despite actual knowledge of his overcharging. And if that's true, why wouldn't that be a negligent failure to supervise?
Well, I think it's tied in somewhat to the Code of Ethics, and Mr. Gaither is certainly going to deal with that issue when he talks about the third-party beneficiary piece of this. But the fact of the matter is that there is no duty created by the Code of Ethics to either train or to perform under that particular Code of Ethics. It's tied into the notion that, in fact, the customer is an incidental beneficiary, just as many other stakeholders, like shareholders, even competitors. And so under those circumstances, the idea of negligence, we believe, just simply doesn't creep into this analysis. We have, as a matter of good corporate governance, decided to set forth a code of ethics. We hope that our people abide by it. It is an aspirational standard that we incorporate in hopes and post-Enron, quite frankly, to make sure that our people try to do the right thing. But in terms of creating an independent cause of action, either as a standard of care, as the Walmart case indicates it is not, or as an obligation to make sure that our people follow that, we don't think it creates a duty. We don't think it expands a duty to that level. If I just might make a couple of concluding arguments regarding the statute of limitations. Have I eaten into your time, Mr. Gaither?
Uh-huh. You're starting to.
Okay. I'm going to take one more minute, and then I'm going to close here.
If in 13 he takes 14.
The point is this. Again, if there's any life to the oral contract claim, that life is taken away as of May 1st, 2001. And in regard to the statute of limitations, the evidence was absolutely clear that they had all of the knowledge necessary to know the amount of spread that was being taken and the amount of profit that was being earned by KeyBank. And then that knowledge was in their head in 1998 and 1999. So therefore, the court's ruling that the statute of limitations extinguished the oral contract claim in 2004 was a correct one. And I'll note suit was not filed until 2005. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Gaither.
Good morning. As Mr. Brown pointed out, my primary task is the third-party beneficiary analysis. The district court held that the contract that Interactive attempts to be the third-party beneficiary of is not really a contract at all. And that's because the alleged contract that's signed by Mr. Ravens is entitled, and this is at 55 in the appendix, Code of Ethics Compliance Certificate. And it is non-promissory. And by that I mean what it says is, I understand that as a condition of my employment with KeyCorp, I must comply with the requirement of the code. I believe what the district court said was this is not a term of a contract, but instead a statement as essentially a condition preceding to being hired. If Mr. Ravens had not signed this, like if he had failed a drug test, he would not be hired. Thus, it's not him promising to comply, but that if he would not sign this acknowledgement, he would not be hired. So whether you see it as a condition precedent or a condition subsequent that would allow his employment to be terminated, it is non-promissory. It certainly also isn't the bank saying it will comply with the Code of Ethics. However,
if Interactive can demonstrate the KeyBank had actual knowledge that Ravens was overcharging and failed to address it, why isn't it responsible for some of the damage that was caused to Interactive?
Well, that presupposes that there was, in fact, overcharging. By overcharging, counsel this morning mentioned that there was an oral contract that no spread would be charged, and thus, by charging a spread, that was, in fact, damaging. But the fact of the matter is, Tracy Shaw, who was the account manager at Interactive and in charge of the day-to-day relationship with Mr. Ravens, at page 502 of the record, she said, what was your understanding of how KeyBank made its profits? I understood that there had to have been a minor spread. And by that, you understood that at the time that Adam Ravens was handling Interactive's transactions, there was a rate out there that KeyBank would obtain for foreign currencies, correct? A wholesale rate, correct? And the KeyBank would mark up, or Interactive would have its rate set by KeyBank marking up that wholesale rate to some retail rate and charging you the difference as a profit. From the first day that Mr. Ravens took over this relationship, he advised Interactive that what he did was wholesale and retail. There was a wholesale rate. He marked it up and charged them the retail rate with the difference representing the profit for the bank. He was never asked what that rate was. There's never been any designation that he lied about it or concealed what the rate was. And so in that setting, it is my contention that there could not have been an overcharging because he disclosed the fact that a spread was being charged and was never asked what that spread was. Now, with respect to the third-party beneficiary analysis, let's assume that it is promissory in nature. Let's assume Mr. Ravens did, contrary to what the district court held, that Mr. Ravens promised that he would comply with the Code of Ethics. When that promise is made, that does not mean that an intended beneficiary status was, in fact, created. As the bench noted, intended beneficiaries require some proof of a right to performance being within the intentions of the parties. That's under Section 302 of the Restatement Second of Contracts that Ohio adopted. There is no evidence in this record that there is any intention that a right of performance be granted to Interactive. In fact, the Code of Ethics itself belies that. It specifically speaks to how it would be enforced. And the Code of Ethics under the section that is entitled Administration specifically states that it will be administered. The Code of Ethics of Key Corp is part of its personnel policies, so that employees who violate the code are subject to the disciplinary measures set forth therein in those policies up to and including termination. That is a far cry from the notion that the parties intended that third parties, customers, prospective customers, the media, competitors, the government, and what it also says is, quote, anyone else with whom Key Corp has contact would be subject to the Code of Ethics. Well, it is inconceivable and thus unreasonable interpretation that that language means that Key Corp intended to cede to anyone in the world the right to come to court and demand a right of performance. The media, for instance, could come into court and seek an injunction requiring the highest ethical standards. The only reasonable interpretation would be that Key Corp decided to hold to itself the power of enforcing its code of ethics under its disciplinary policies. It could decide whether Mr. Ravens would be terminated, whether he would be suspended, given a written reprimand, or not at all. There is no extrinsic evidence that's been designated by Interactive to show any intention whatsoever to do anything other than perhaps confer an indirect benefit on customers. There is no evidence that the bank or Mr. Ravens intended to actually grant a right of performance, a right to demand performance, thus be a lawsuit. So because of that, it is, in fact, an incidental, not an intended beneficiary, and the entire claim falls whether or not this is promissory in nature or not, as the district court found. Finally, I would only point the court to the record that does state that Mr. Ravens from day one told Interactive it was going to charge a spread, and that's exactly what he did. So there couldn't be a breach, even if the Code of Ethics did in fact apply. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Oberhauser has 7 minutes.
Thank you, and I don't think I'll need all of that 7 minutes. First, with regard to Mr. Brown's discussion.
Maybe you could tell me why any company would have a code of ethics if outsiders not within the company could be claimed or be deemed to be third-party beneficiaries of it.
Why would they?
Yeah.
Because they want to publicize their business. They want to try to promote their business and attract new customers. I think the financial services industry is one in particular.
You're not going to. Interactive didn't rely on the existence of a code of ethics with KeyBank when they started doing business with them, did they?
There's no
evidence of that.
There's no evidence of that in the record that's before this court.
And I just think if you had if it was a viable theory that a customer was a third-party beneficiary of a company's that they're doing business with code of ethics, that a company in its own self-interest would not want to have code of ethics.
The simple fact of the matter is that there are a number of other cases across the country that have allowed third parties to enforce as third-party beneficiaries code of ethics that other companies have subscribed to. And I think that's a sound policy. It does promote good ethical behavior among corporations. And as I itemized further, the facts of this case are very narrow. There's a whole second set of contracts in which they agreed to comply with the code of ethics. They have an ethics compliance officer. They require training, so on and so forth. I think I heard Mr. Brown say that he conceded that the breach of oral contract claims could be maintained at least up until the time that they believe this written agreement went into effect. I would simply note that even if this written document was determined to be a contract, it does not contain a merger clause, Quite to the contrary, it contemplates that there being other terms and conditions beyond those specified in that written document. Specifically, Section 2 of it states that the terms, quote, would typically consummate by telephonic or oral communication, unquote. Mr. Brown also mentioned the point of these FX transactions being, as he called them, well-papered. However, in all of the FX transactions, KeyBank's internal exchange rate was never identified in any of them. The only exchange rate that was on those confirmations was the all-in rate, the rate that had the transaction fee incorporated into it.
Is that that unusual in your industry?
I can't comment on whether or not it's usual in the industry. All I can say is that in this case, there were only all-in exchange rates quoted on the confirmations to that Interactive received.
I mean, the whole thing sounds like the Wild West, doesn't it?
Well, we have a contract here. We have a contract in which they agreed not to charge a spread, and I think it's undisputed that, in fact, they did charge a spread. And it's undisputed that KeyBank came back and admitted that they had overcharged. Well, if they overcharged, there must have been some agreement in place limiting how much they could charge. It's as simple as that, Your Honor. Mr. Brown spoke briefly about the statute of limitations on the breach of contract claim. I would simply add that under the case of Conkle v. Henson, which is cited in the brief, Each time an FX transaction occurred in which a spread was applied, that was a separate breach of contract, and the statute of limitations began to run anew on it. Interactive would concede that for those transactions occurring more than 6 years prior to the date the complaint was filed, it's barred by the statute of limitations on its oral contract claim. But the vast majority of the transactions, including all of those executed by Adam Ravens, were within that six-year window. Mr. Gaither made the argument that all that was signed by Mr. Ravens was a certification that he had read and agreed to comply with the Code of Ethics. However, I direct your attention to the appendix at page 54, which is the document bearing Adam Raven's signature. And it contains far more than just the agreement to comply with the Code of Ethics. It contains language comprising a formal release of KeyBank and others for individuals relating to his investigation. He agrees to keep information in confidence. All of these are identified as being conditions of employment. Your Honors, I submit that this document reads more like a contract and should be enforced as a contract to which Interactive can be a third-party beneficiary. Finally, Mr. Gaither raised the issue about whether Interactive is truly an indirect beneficiary or a direct beneficiary or some other kind of beneficiary. I would simply submit that that is an issue of fact that should be determined by the jury and is not appropriate for resolution on a motion for summary judgment. Your Honor, KeyBank in this case admitted they had a rogue trader. They admitted he overcharged Interactive, and fortunately they took the action of letting him go. Interactive has been damaged to the tune of $2.1 million, and we respectfully request that the lower court's decision be reversed. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you.